Rene Redzepi has done a rather brave thing. His latest book, called A Work in Progress, is actually three separate books in one package. It combines a book of 100 brand new recipes, an album of 200 candid snapshots, and a very revealing journal he kept for a year that includes the trials he went through in developing new dishes for his world-famous and very influential restaurant. The books are published by Fiden. Rene Redzepi's Copenhagen establishment, Noma, was named the world's best restaurant for 3 years in a row, and I'm delighted to have this chance to talk with him again. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you.
Are these all supposed to be read at the same time? If not, where do you think we should start?
With the journal, definitely. That, in fact, we even contemplated just publishing it as a journal without recipes.
Well, you could have put some recipes in the
back. We could have put some recipes in the back, but at the end, I was a bit afraid of that because I'm a cook. I do recipes. That's what I do. So I decided that we should also have recipes in there. And then the designer actually took them and said, this is not one book. This is actually three books.
And the recipes are all month by month.
Mm-hmm.
That's important, too, especially when you live in an area like Denmark,
yeah,
where you have to think a lot about the changes of the seasons.
Yeah. That's actually paramount to everything that we do. Everything that we sort of, the way we organize our restaurant, our creativity, our year is depending on whatever the weather will give us. So we had to sort of divide it out. I know that there are supposedly four seasons in a calendar year, but to us at the restaurant, there are literally at least 12.
In the journal, you have these initials that tell us to refer to the other two books.
Yeah.
So S is look at the snapshot.
Yeah.
Now, have you always kept a journal?
No. I have never kept a journal before. I never intended to keep one. In fact, I was embarrassed of keeping a journal at first.
Well, you reveal all sorts of things that some chefs might not want to reveal.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the journal was initially just meant to be for me as a test to make our restaurant a better place to work in and see if we could progress somehow by understanding the day-to-day operations better.
So when did you decide to go public with it?
Well, my publisher read it, parts of it. She loved it. We're friends. She said, this is a book. And then in this huge new transition where cooks suddenly become sort of projected into pop culture, there were some friends of mine, friends of mine that read it, and they were very happy about it. And they thought that this would be cool for people to get an understanding of.
Even though sometimes you show yourself in less than flattering terms, you must have had some qualms about that.
No, absolutely not. Listen, I mean, our trade is this strange, mysterious, magical, crazy trade where you know, we sort of tap out of reality for the years you're in it. Some stay forever. Some stay all life. And I think it's not a bad thing to open up. I'm against doing things that I'm afraid of saying.
You start in February after you've taken off all of January and admit that 4 months prior, despite having every reason to be ecstatic, you were far from it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a bad moment. We'd won the world's best restaurant for the first time. I'd put out the previous book. Nobody was able to cook from it, but it was really selling. Everything was...
No one was able to cook from it because it depended so much on foraging in the Copenhagen area.
Exactly. And suddenly we were full all the time. But for some strange reason, it was almost as if we reached a mountaintop, or people were telling me that. That's it. You're now the world's best, whatever that means, but you're there. Stay there. Don't move around. And as a 32-year-old thinking that that's it, now you have the villa and the Volvo and the dog and the marriage, it was kind of a disheartening moment.
And success can actually have its toll on relationships.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean... Yeah.
You tell your wife, Nadine, about your worries concerning your sous chef, and she's less than sympathetic. She says, you spent more time with him than with me and your child.
Yeah. Yeah. Another testament to this crazy trade win, you know.
So was it difficult for you to be able to leave the restaurant for a month?
No, not at that time. When I was at the moment at the end of 2010 and thinking, what's happening here? Why am I suddenly afraid of making these decisions that a month earlier made total sense to me? I didn't know what's going on, and with enough time spent like that, you sort of also change your personality. And I needed to leave now. And my wife, she was actually the one who said, Renee, you can't leave now. The restaurant is the world's best. You have to stay. Everybody wants you there. And I told her, listen, if I don't leave now, I don't even know where I will be in 6 months.
Well, how important is your presence? Because there are lots of chefs who bring in good staff, and they just rely on them to keep it going. They come back after a month or two and say, oh, you're putting too much saffron in this, and cut back on it a little bit, and then they can go away again.
Well, I mean, you certainly can do that. To me, I'm not at that stage yet. Some are magical leaders. They know how to operate and do these things. To me, I still have one job. I have a restaurant, and this is my job. This is what I run, and I like that. I like to be at my restaurant.
What about your staff? Do you think it was a good thing for them to be their own for a while?
Oh, yeah. It was magical. I mean, even writing the journal and stepping away a bit and loosening the reins, so to speak, and giving out some tasks made our restaurant better.
Where did you go?
Mexico.
Because you wanted to try a very different kind of cuisine?
Mostly, I just wanted to be as far away from the restaurant in case something were to happen, they'd call me. I wouldn't just be on a plane home. I knew that if it was somewhere in Europe, I would actually do that.
And Mexico was warmer in February or January than Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And the food can be quite extraordinary.
Well,
were you recharging your batteries in a way?
Yeah, recharging the batteries, but also be discovering a food nation that I hadn't seen before. I was in Denmark. We have Mexican restaurants on every corner. But, you know, it's a sort of a bad version of Tex-Mex that we get in Denmark. So I'd always seen Mexican food as something sort of rather cheap and not delicious. And then you travel there, and it's one of the great cuisines of the world.
And it's been pointed out to me by a famous Mexican chef that it has more dishes than any cuisine other than China.
Yeah,
because there are so many different regions
and
so many different influences, the French, the English.
Lebanese as well. Oh, yeah. I mean, you feel that when you're
there. Dutch.
The Dutch one. From east to west, north to south, it's mind-boggling.
So did it, when you came home, were you influenced at all? Did you change your approach at all?
Yeah. The freshness and the sort of laissez-faire, the intuition-based cooking that they do a lot. Yeah, that influenced me. But mostly I was struck by the sheer magnitude of historical cooking that they have there. And it fueled me. It fueled me because that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to set a new paradigm for what is flavor for a region. And so looking at what history can do to you, it feels like a good thing what we're doing.
How old were you when you started working in kitchens?
15.
And you say that when you started cooking, you were lucky if you ever saw the dining room where you worked.
Yeah.
Once you become a celebrity chef, aren't you expected to work your way through the dining room at least a few times each time?
Well, you know,
stop
I don't
at
know.
The tables.
Celebrity
of the
chef, I don't know about that one.
Well,
I
if think, you have the world's most famous, considered the world's greatest restaurant, whether that's true or not, I haven't eaten at your restaurant, so I'll withhold my judgment. But still.
Yeah.
People do expect you to be some really important celebrity.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I don't know. I mean, I am there. And now we have an open kitchen. And I walk through there. I serve the food. I'm there. I greet people when they come in. I say hello to them. And I don't know. I don't feel that celebrity-ness at all. Rather, you should go back to the kitchen and cook my meal now, please, chef.
But there is that contact is important to you because you didn't have it in the past?
Yeah, that's very important. That gave a huge sense of sort of belonging to me in the restaurant trade, or a sense of, like, this is what cooking is about. This is what operating a restaurant. It is about the guests. So why aren't we seeing them? Why aren't we spending time with them just like you would in your home? And since we're spending more time at the restaurant than in our home, set it up as a home. And that's what I did.
My guest is Rene Redzepi, whose latest book is actually three books packaged under the title A Work in Progress, published by Phaeton. Do you find it slightly ironic that your restaurant would be so well received when the weather in Copenhagen provides so many restrictions, especially during the long winters?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the in 10 years ago when we opened, there certainly wasn't anything written in the cards that 10 years later I would be sitting on the Len Lopate show and talking about, you know, how wonderful it's gone. Yeah, I think it was a surprise to everybody, including ourselves, the people of Scandinavia, that there was enough food, that there was enough imagination to actually deal with that long, hard winter that lasts sometimes 4, 5, 6 months, where everything, and I literally mean everything, is a block of ice.
And you tell at one point about how ecstatic you got in deep February when you were given a bag of chickweed.
Yeah.
Many people considered that the most hateful of all weeds.
Oh, I love it. when we get chickweed in there, and sometimes when suddenly there's a spike of early spring, it's like New Year's Eve and Christmas together and your birthday. You know, it's like Mother Nature telling you, I'm about to come back to life. Get ready for this. And we've been waiting for that. So I love that. Even chickweed. That, by the way, tastes like baby corn. Delicious.
Is spring your favorite time of year?
No.
What's your favorite season to cook?
It would have to be sometime between August and September. The big harvest is about to set in. There's still lots of forage foods. The seaweeds are there. Shellfish is back in season. All the vegetables, the fields are like explosive of variety. That's probably my favorite season.
And you do change your menu with the seasons, but I suspect that there are always some dishes that you, well, you say they can become almost sacred. Customers have come to expect to find. Yeah. Are you afraid of taking them off the menu or changing them at all?
Not anymore. I was that initially before the journal. You know, I thought the menu we had during that year, that was the menu we should keep sort of forever and just keep tweaking it a little bit because that's what people sort of expected.
Developing signature dishes.
Yeah. And we do have signature dishes, but no, we change it constantly, all the time. This is important. Not so much for the guests, but for us. We work a lot. We're there all the time. We need that constant change to be sort of to keep our imagination and intuition intact.
What were some of the signature dishes?
There was one of our most iconic dishes was a very simple serving. Now imagine a huge langoustine, the size of an arm.
Really?
Yeah, huge.
You can get them in Denmark?
We get them from the waters near the Faroe Islands, and they're caught in deep waters. They're so sweet, and the color is like the red, like a sunset. Really intense.
They must be very old to get them.
They are. I don't know how old, but sure, they are old, and it's rare to get them. They always catch them. But, you know, they would mix them in with all the different sizes. So we get only those large ones. And we roasted them on a grill, and they become sweet, and the juices burst out when you bite into them. And then we had this sort of, not puree, but a cream made from fresh wild oysters that we mixed with a bit of oil and a bit of seaweed and a bit of parsley. And then, you know, the oyster in itself acts like an egg yolk, so it was almost like a mayonnaise consistency, just deep, intense of ocean flavors. And then you just sat there with your huge langoustine and dipped the cooked flesh into this wonderful ocean-like dipping.
And you stopped making that.
And we stopped making it. We just done it too much. Because, you know, you can't do it anymore. You simply can't attack it with the same enthusiasm.
But you're constantly trying to perfect a dish, but there comes a point where you probably can't go any further.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you know, the word perfection, if it does exist. I know that once you feel you've reached something close by, that's when you always get bored and want something new.
Well, do you start with a classic dish and then rethink it, deconstruct it?
No. I'm not a big fan of deconstruction, and you know, and we're also lucky. We're in sort of cold, old, boring Scandinavia, where there isn't much classical food to actually be inspired from. So we are always guided by that ever-changing season, which in Scandinavia can change week by week, day by day.
Now, you were just 25 when you became the head chef and also co-owner of Noma.
Yeah.
I should point out it only has 40 tables.
No, we have 40 seats.
40 seats,
yeah.
Right.
So, only 11 tables.
So that's really small.
Yeah.
That means, of course, that you can have a hands-on approach to every dish. But on the other hand, It also means that you've got to charge an awful lot to make a restaurant with a huge staff go.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of these trades that I think it's manual labor. You're going to need hands. And like us, when, for instance, we have a vegetable-driven cuisine. Most of the food we serve are based on plants and fruits and vegetables. But you know what? In comparison to a steak and having that carrot fresh off the soil, still sticking with the biodynamic soil, cleaning that takes 10 times longer than cutting a nice steak from the animal. So it is just much more labor intensive as well. And hopefully it will always stay that. Hopefully cooking will always be a manual labor.
And so most of the dishes are vegetable based.
Yeah.
Although it's not a vegetarian restaurant.
No.
It's about eating that carrot at just the right moment it's been picked.
Yeah.
Just before you started cleaning it.
Yeah, and then you cook it in a way where it still has that same satisfactional level like eating a steak, of course. So yeah, that is what we do, and I find so much more joy in the diversity from the plant kingdom. I mean, if I were to choose between berries, mushrooms, roots, legumes, herbs, fruits, apples, and so on, and then steaks, well, I know what I would choose.
You are famous for foraging, mm-hmm. but how much foraging can you do in January, February, and March?
Nothing. Zero. You can walk on ice. That's what you can. You can take your hammer and thistle and crack off the frozen grass. But there we rely on all the stuff that we put into storage during spring, summer, and autumn. And we literally have a room that is three times the size of this studio, which is fairly big. And we call it Frankenstein's house because that's where all the ingredients go for their afterlife.
And those are the things that you forage. But you've also said that a friendship changed your restaurant at the very beginning because it was with a farmer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The farmer was telling you what you should be serving?
Yeah. Yeah. At that time when we opened, I had never really talked to a farmer 10 years ago. We just called up a number and, somebody would deliver what you'd ordered. And suddenly I found myself meeting with all these people in search of ingredients. And some of them were incredibly sort of passionate and they had all these diversity and flavors. And they were sort of specialists in their trade. And they were the ones sort of with time telling us, listen, these ingredients, they're good now. But they also do sprout. And there's a flowering season that's magical. Have you never tried that before? You should try that. What about when they go into stem? Next year, we should put this variety in. And they were sort of dictating essentially what we put on our menu. Then we would transform it, of course, cook it. But they decided which ingredients came on the menu. And I think that's wonderful.
Now, you had earlier worked at El Bulli, the celebrated restaurant, unfortunately, no longer with us, mm-hmm. Of Ferran Adrià in northern Spain. But his approach is totally different, isn't it?
I think that, you know, we share this pursuit of something that's delicious and the celebration of that, of something that's delicious. We are two restaurants in two different parts of the world, so naturally there will be differences. In our case, operating a restaurant in Copenhagen, we are 5 million people. We're 25 million people in all the Nordic region in a landmass that's enormous, where nature literally is unspoiled, untouched, and step into it, you found a bounty of ingredients. So that's natural that it guides us in other ways than in comparison to a restaurant in Spain.
But he also is famous for using chemistry. You, yeah. On the other hand, at one point in your journal, tell your staff in your test kitchen two words, trash cooking.
Yeah.
That means cooking with the things that other people throw away.
Yeah. This was one of those moments during a very tough winter, and we're literally running out of ingredients, running out of ideas. And as it is, people are constantly flowing in, guests, and people come week by week, and we had to change. And so in order to step out of that funk, that mental funk, we basically just said, listen, there's something wrong here. What about the stuff that we usually don't see as valuable enough to be in the menu? And that changed things quite a bit for us.
And then you came to rely on what you call a colony of suppliers.
Yeah.
So you had that farmer, and then you had foresters, hunters, yeah. divers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have more than 200 suppliers. One of them has two mulberry trees that are 220 years old, and we take all that. And another one delivers fjord shrimps for us. And, they're all sort of specialists in their trade. But more so than that, they're also part of the community and sort of the team, I would say.
Now, foraging has become popular in this area as well. In fact, we've spoken to a number of people who actually have made a business of it. You've said that what I saw as scenery before became a big larder.
Yeah.
So when did you get the inspiration to do foraging as part of your cuisine?
That came when we first opened 10 years ago. I was so lucky to stumble upon on the internet a PDF of a Swedish Army survival book in which you could survive 1 year, stuck in wilderness. And I was reading about all these ingredients that I've been walking by all my life, like bulrush, for instance. And it said there that they tasted like hearts of palm. And I'm like, what? We have ingredients that tasted like a palm tree in cold, icy Scandinavia? And it just changed things.
Well, we don't have much time, but you said that your first cookbook was really hard for people to actually cook from. What about this book for somebody who lives in New York?
It's simpler this time. We've simplified things. And not just because we wanted to do it, just a natural reaction. We're more confident. The food is simpler, but you're still going to have to go to the markets, get those great ingredients.
And Rene Redzepi's A Work in Progress is really three books that are all interrelated, a journal, a cookbook, and also a book of snapshots. It's published by Phaidon. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
It's
been a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure.